And welcome to Weather and Ag in Focus on this Monday, February 24th, 1:06 in the afternoon. Temperatures in the lower 40s outside, and there's a little bit of light rain on radar to the southwest of the FM area, stretching from about Rutland up through Dickey, and that's moving southeastward. So, yeah, rain and not snow for parts of the area. This is all going to stay south of the 94 corridor if you have any outdoor plans this afternoon. I'm Chief Meteorologist Dean Wysocki, along with our Ag Director, Bridget Riedel. Bridget, welcome to Monday. How was your weekend?
Doing well, and you're right. I think this is a bit of a surprise to many of us. I'm in Jamestown, North Dakota, looking at 44 degrees. So, yay for all of us. A lot of snow melt just since Saturday, as I've noticed. If you had snow cover, that's really changed over very quickly, I might add.
It has, yeah, no doubt about it. Ice continues to melt. Other than that, though, I mean, above normal temperatures continue, and I really don't see a whole lot changing here over the next couple of weeks. We're going to see temperatures generally above normal. Now, we'll see our cool shots here and there, but nothing like we had over the last couple of weeks. So we're looking at temperatures outside right now in the low to mid 40s across the area, and that's about where we'll stay for the rest of the afternoon. And again, a few light showers south of 94 with winds out of the west at about 10 to 20. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, mid to upper 20s. And Tuesday, another weak system moves into the area from Canada, and that will give us, mostly cloudy skies. I think we'll see some sunshine early in the morning and then clouds sticking up. Highs right around 40 tomorrow, then a little light rain overspreads the eastern third of the state tomorrow night. And then that will lead to cooler weather for Wednesday and Thursday, highs in the upper 30s to near 40. And then Friday, we're looking at a stronger clipper system racing through northern Minnesota. That will give us quite a bit of wind, but most of the precip with that should be in the far northern valley into northern Minnesota. But it will cool us down into the 30s on Friday, 20s on Saturday, and then back up into the low 40s on Sunday. Taking a look into next week, it looks pretty quiet. Kind of like this week, couple of clipper systems, temperatures above normal, and that puts us through the first week in March. And again, this is our phase two of the LRC cycle. We'll go back to the stormy phase after, let's say, 7th through the 10th of March. I think after the 10th, our storm chances really start to increase as we head towards mid and latter parts of March. So we'll see a couple of quiet weeks weather-wise for the most part with temperatures pretty much at or above normal. And then things will start to change in March. I call this false spring because, we're not done. We're not done with winter yet. Sorry.
We're going to have a few bouts of these yet, I am sure. And that's why, you know, we're going to keep paying attention to what happens on a very regular basis as far as temperature swings, because you're going to plan for that, whether you're traveling, whether you're calving, whether you thought you would get in a big ice fishing trip, et cetera. So don't be shy about checking out those temperatures well in advance before you go. That'd be a good idea.
Yeah, and I believe, isn't it this, is it Friday or Saturday that the ice houses have to be off the lakes, Bridget? Isn't it the last day of the month?
Usually it is right at the end of February, and that means you just can't leave them on overnight.
Permanent,
you can still take them on during the day, yeah, but you got to pull them back and forth off there. Yes. Yep. Well, so for those who are listening to the weather update, thank you to Ryan Bonesack with Equitable AgriFinance. He is our sponsor. He always provides us long-term and fixed rates for farmland financing, and he's here to help you as local farmers and ranchers to do so. If you have questions, get Ryan on the phone. You can reach him at 701-261-6529 and talk to Ryan Bonesack. And again, that's Equitable AgriFinance, who sponsors our weather.
So we're playing a game here at the studio, Bridget.
And what's that?
The game is, Addison,
where in the world is famed Weather and Ag in Focus host Bridget Riedel today?
Today, I am actually in the passenger seat of my vehicle, which is what's probably thrown you completely off.
Right.
usually I'm fighting with a steering wheel. I'm in Jamestown, and I've got some events to take care of here today, but the rest of the week will include things like the farms meetings that are going to be happening. That has to do with some grant proposals. There's a meeting in Devil's Lake and another evening in Grafton, so I'm going to try to get to at least one of those. There's a bull sale on the calendar for later this week. There are some events out at Grand Farm that I've been invited to, so there should be plenty going on. Next week, I will be in Denver for Commodity Classic. Looking forward to that.
Nice. And what days Is that next week, Bridget?
Commodity Classic will kick off on Sunday, and that will run through Tuesday. I'll be down there, and I've already got my farm equipment lined up, so Addison gets a view of whatever piece of equipment I'm sitting in that day to do the show. I already got those things taken care of for Monday and Tuesday. And those of you who watch our live streams on Facebook, YouTube, as well as Acres TV, you can go right ahead and catch on to where I'm at and what I'm doing when I'm away from the studio, you might say. There's a lot of those days.
You're always on the road. No kidding.
There's always some place.
Yes, there is.
So, okay, a quick reminder to a lot of you who farm, have your own LLCs, small businesses, etc. We've gone back and forth on this deal several times, and that is the Corporate Transparency Act. First, we had to have it done by the end of the year. Then we didn't. There was a judicial injunction, and it's gone back and forth a couple of times. Where are we at on this deal today? Today, as of last Friday. You still have to go in by, I think it's March 21st, to put in your information for the Corporate Transparency Act. Why? Why does it affect small businesses? Essentially, this was put into law in order to keep money laundering operations from happening in various places, and one of them, of course, being in the United States. So if you were a business here, you wanted to prove your legitimacy. And then it was overruled, and it's gone back and forth several times. But as of late in the day, Friday afternoon, we are back to having to put in our information for the Corporate Transparency Act. If you're curious where, all you have to do is Google it. The link pops up. It's part of the IRS website. It takes less than 10 minutes to get it done. It's not hard to do. Might as well just get it over with because I know this thing has gone back and forth a few times. And as one of our other co-hosts, Jay Stedman, pointed out, you know, the IRS is okay with it if you don't look like you're trying to do something shady. Then they're going to watch you really closely because this non-compliance was somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000 fines that would be associated with it. So I did mine. Everybody else, just go ahead, check it out, get the Corporate Transparency Act work done for you so you don't have to worry about it. That's one thing. So then SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, they had come out about 2 years ago with a rule. They called it their carbon emissions test, carbon emissions reporting. So what that meant was that all the way down to a farm level, and this was, there were certain segments of it, there was scope 1, 2, and 3. Scope 3 was most likely going to affect farms and agribusinesses. So if you farmed and you wanted to sell your crop to certain other entities, right? Even if it wanted to go as far as, say, General Mills or Kellogg's, what was going to have to happen was you would have to track your carbon footprint all the way from the time you put the seed in the ground. So how was the seed raised? What was the carbon footprint of that? Or how much diesel fuel did it take to raise your calf crop? What type of background do you know about your feed supplements? All of this had to factor into this scope 3 that was part of the SEC ruling on carbon emissions. That is looking to be overturned. That's a good idea because it was going to add a lot of time, paperwork, and expense to getting it done for so many folks in agribusiness and especially for small farms. So that looks to like that's going to be overturned before we really even got to the point of having a report on it, meaning that as farmers, you wouldn't have had to turn in anything. So knock on wood, that's going to go away for a while. So we won't have to think about that either. So look, just plenty of other things that we have had to deal with from one day to the other.
It's always something, right?
There's been a lot. It's been fairly interesting to watch where some of these things have gone and how they've been taken care of. So doesn't the weather get this exciting, Dean? We were talking all about money and government.
Normally, yeah. Not this week, though. But I'm sure something will pop up.
Well, additionally, for all of you who are farmers that have been watching some of the governmental freezes that have happened, USDA immediately said, hey, a lot of our funds are frozen, and farmers were concerned about that for a couple of particular programs that they might be enrolled in. New USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins says there will be a release of about $20 million in funding from USDA. That's going to go to contracts that were, there was an enrollment for the EQIP program, the Environmental Quality Incentive Program that's administered through NRCS, the Conservation Stewardship Program, CSP, and then also the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program. So those dollars, after all of this freeze thaw, you might say, those are going to be released. That's about $20 million. If you have questions, make sure you check that out with your NRCS office to see how that may apply to you. look, all these things you got to go do. You got to report. You don't have to report the other one, but you still got to go check in at NRCS.
It's hard to keep. It's hard to keep everything right side up. It seems like.
Oh, that's a good thing. Why we have all these reminders that come out to all of you. So, right. Other reminders. Well, we've got a great reminder about our guest today. I'm looking forward to this. Derek Pratt is going to be joining us. He is with the Erie Canal Museum. He's the historian for the canal. When you think about agricultural product movement, we often refer to the Mississippi River because of the barge traffic. But in the past, we did so much work on the Erie Canal. How much was it? Well, Derek's going to help us talk about that. So we're going to touch base with the American Ag Network. Welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus. Thanks for being here this afternoon. Hopefully you're enjoying this wonderful 40-degree weather outside and getting some other things done that maybe had to wait a while. Well, we are joined today by Derek Pratt. He is with the Erie Canal Museum. He's their historian. And Derek, how are you?
Good. How are you?
We are great. So glad you're joining us today. So are you a lifelong New Yorker?
Yep. I'm from right outside of Syracuse, Chittenango, New York. It's a canal town, and I've been here my whole life, yeah.
Excellent. So you grew up around...
Oh, I was about to say, my family's actually from the border of the Dakotas and Minnesota as well, way back.
Hold on. So they went out here and then went back to New York?
Yes. In the 1930s, they moved back to a farm here in upstate New York. So
I can see why that made sense, because the 1930s here weren't always so pleasant. Let's put it that way.
that's the story in America, generally. Yeah.
So speaking of stories, tell us a little bit about the Erie Canal. It has been so well known in many instances, except maybe agriculturally. So give us a little background.
Yeah, so actually this is a big year on the canal in general. It's actually the canal's bicentennial this year of its opening. It was built by New York State from 1817 to 1825, and it connected Lake Erie, and therefore all the upper Great Lakes at Buffalo to Albany and the Hudson River, which goes all the way to New York and the Atlantic Ocean. So it was really the first really efficient transportation route between the Great Lakes and the Atlantic Ocean, you know, because you have the Appalachian Mountain chain running all the way up the East Coast. So it was transformative. It took about a month prior to the canal's construction to get from Buffalo to New York City, and cost around $100 per ton of wheat to transport. After the canal's opening, it took 5 to 7 days to make the same journey, and it cost less than $10 to transport the same amount of wheat. So it was kind of revolutionary for shipping.
And Derek, is the canal still being used for ag purposes today or for any shipping purposes at all?
Well, the canal is mostly used for recreational boating now. When the St. Lawrence Seaway opened, it could take much larger boats. Primarily what moves commercially on the canal is oversized goods that can't really fit on the railroads or on the highway. There was a notable moment a few years ago when Genesee Brewing Company transported these massive beer tanks down the canal. But really the canal's main use for agriculture these days is that in western New York, it is used as an irrigation source for a lot of western New York farms.
So as you think about the history of the canal, was it primarily transportation of other goods and services? Did farmers have a big say in the building and construction of it?
Oh, farming was huge. New York farmers were some of the main advocates for it. So really, kind of the basis for the canal is often pointed to this man, Jesse Hawley, who was a grain merchant in the Finger Lakes region of New York. He went bankrupt because of the poor transportation network within New York. At least that's in part why he went bankrupt. And he writes a series of essays from debtor's prison are called the Hercules Essays, kind of expounding on why this statewide canal should be constructed. And a lot of other people see the benefit to that. So it's a grain merchant who kind of starts it off. And then Rochester, New York becomes this major center for wheat production. It becomes known as the Flour, F-L-O-U-R city. And grain interests especially play a huge role on the canal in perpetuity, kind of. Buffalo soon becomes a huge grain port, taking in a lot of the Midwest's grain from around the Great Lakes Basin. There's a huge General Mills plant there still. Yeah, it's actually grain merchants in Buffalo and in New York City who really push for the modern barge canal, which was constructed in the early 1900s, which is what you can take a boat on today. Agricultural products play a key role in the entire history of the canal.
Wow. Bigger than I would have imagined as well. When you say a grain merchant was really the guy who kicked off the whole idea, really, when you think about it.
Yeah. It's pretty impressive.
It's very impressive. So as you think about what started to move on the canal, was it ever really much for livestock, or was it primarily just grain that was going to move? Because I know Western New York has a big agricultural region that not many people think about.
Yeah, a lot of folks think of New York as New York City, and that's only a small kind of little corner of the state. Most of the land around here is kind of agricultural in use. Not a lot of livestock moves on the canal that I am aware of, though all the boats are actually pulled by horses and mules for the most part. That's really the primary livestock moving along, though pork is one of the early major goods that moves on the canal. You have what's called Black Rock pork, becomes an early kind of brand name, if you will. Black Rock's right by Buffalo. The canal also changes agriculture by making it easier for settlers to move into the Great Lakes Basin. So after kind of the canal opens up, people start moving into Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, et cetera, which all have better kind of growing climates than New York. So they start producing wheat, and New York farmers were then forced to diversify to produce higher value crops. So as a result, into the 1870s, New York is the leading agricultural producer of the states in the Union, and it's the number one producer in things like vegetables. A lot of different towns in New York, they have their distinct kind of agricultural product. For instance, Lyons, New York is called the peppermint capital of America. Little Falls becomes the cheese capital of the world briefly, so on and so forth.
Wow. But when you think about it, there's a lot of agriculture in states like New York, as well as, say, Michigan or the southern half of Idaho, where things happen that we just don't even think about on a regular basis over here. And one of the things that you mentioned was the cheese. Little Falls was known for their cheese. Dairy has always played a big role in the area as well. And are you familiar with any of the industry right around the Erie Canal that you work with?
So the dairy industry in New York has taken a hit in recent years. Actually, Little Falls, very interestingly, we see the same processes that I just kind of described playing out nowadays, where it becomes increasingly hard for New York farmers to compete, because not only now do we have, you know, Midwest farmers to compete with, there's also like the Rio Grande Valley and Southern California and Florida, where you can grow stuff all year round, kind of. So people are moving to even higher value crops. A great example is in Little Falls. They have water buffalo farms that produce things like water buffalo cheese and milk, as well as water buffalo steaks you can get.
Okay. I wasn't expecting a water buffalo discussion today, but yet here we are. So we're at the bottom of the hour, Derek. Don't go anywhere. We've got some more questions for you. And we want to touch base after we come back from listening to our news. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Okay, now I remember that song. I'm old enough. Addison, do you have any clue?
I didn't know what this was until I played it. I'm going to be honest.
Okay. And Bridget, do you remember this song? Oh, yeah.
I remember learning this in elementary school.
Right? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, oh, exactly. Nice. So welcome back to Weather and Ag and Focus. Our special guest today, Derek Pratt, he's the Erie Canal Museum historian. And Derek, I thought I heard you correctly about that mules and horses used to pull the barges through the canal. Is that correct?
Yep. Okay. All the way until 1918.
All right. Now, how many horses and mules would it take?
Typically, your average canal boat was pulled by 2 to 3 mules. The boats operated 24 hours a day, though, so a lot of boats had stables right in the bow. Others, if you were part of a larger company, you'd have stables kind of positioned all along the banks.
And how long would it take them to pull the barges through the canal?
About 5 to 7 days.
Wow.
Depending on traffic jams.
Sure.
And stuff.
Okay.
So the boats not only had freight on them, but they had to allow for the fact that they had their own horsepower, literally, or mule power, on the boat as well, right?
Yep. And you also had to have living quarters for your crew, too.
These are a lot bigger boats than I thought of, I'll be honest.
Sure, yeah. They're about 100 feet long. There are three different kind of versions of the canal. The first one that they built was 40 feet wide and 4 feet deep, which isn't particularly big. And they realized that pretty quick. So they built a 70-foot wide, 7-foot deep one, which is kind of the more classic one you're more familiar with. Those could carry about 250 tons of goods on them.
Okay.
And a modern canal boat does about 2,500 tons.
Okay. Speaking of the modern, we aren't using horses and mules anymore to move the boats through. How are we doing that? How does the canal system work?
The modern canal system, unlike previous versions, they were able to kind of modify existing waterways in a lot of places, like the Mohawk Valley or River and the Oneida Lake. Though Western New York, it's still an artificial channel, 120 feet wide and 12 feet deep. It overcomes elevation change through locks, which are essentially elevators for boats. They just use the natural kind of gravity and need for water to balance itself out, to move boats up and down. Nowadays, they use primarily diesel engines. Interestingly, canal shipping is about 90 times more efficient than a single tractor trailer. So New York started to try to push people to try to use the canal a bit more, but we'll see.
When you say it's 90 times more efficient, do you mean just by the efficiency of the use of the diesel fuel or in any other way?
Yeah, fuel efficiency primarily. It's slower than taking, you know, the railroad or a truck. But if you have non-perishable goods, you know, it's cheaper too, from what I understand, if you can get a canal barge, which are fewer and far between nowadays than they were during its heyday.
So that's kind of a big question. What moves on the canal today? Do you still move some agricultural goods?
There's relatively little in terms of agricultural goods. Out in the eastern part of the canal system, especially the Champlain Canal, which is a side canal off of the Erie, they move a lot of stone and copper wiring, these giant like spools of copper wires. But also just bulk goods. So you get some shipments of stone moving up and down the canal. We've had prefabricated bridges move on the canal recently, parts to a nuclear submarine a year or two ago.
Those sound like awesome little ideas.
Yes.
And you mentioned irrigation. So do you have any statistics on how the canal gets used for irrigation these days, on like number of acres or any of those types of things? Or how did that begin is maybe a bigger question.
So the canal's waters have been used by entities other than shippers for pretty much as long as it's existed. Originally, mill owners used it, the kind of excess water from locks to power water wheels and stuff. But irrigation really started almost as soon as the modern barge canal opened up. We know an orchard out in Holly, New York, Herd Orchards, they're great. They have a license dating back to the 1930s to use irrigation water from the canal system. I don't have exact numbers on how many acres are today using it. During this bicentennial period, New York had what's called the Reimagine the Canals Commission, which hoped to make the canals relevant for the next 200 years. And one of the big initiatives was trying to convince farmers in Western New York to utilize more irrigation water from the canal to mitigate droughts, which upstate New York is more at risk with climate change. So.
This may sound odd, but now that I think about it, sure. Because knowing that the canal, as you mentioned, is connecting from the Great Lakes out to the sea waters of the Atlantic, does that mean that there's ever seawater in the canal? So would that affect their irrigation, or what's the composition of the water?
So all of this water that's being used for irrigation primarily comes from Lake Erie. So the way the canal works, its highest point is Buffalo on Lake Erie. And water, of course, does not travel uphill, even with locks. All the water comes down from Lake Erie, no water from kind of the Hudson River heads up into the system. So it's all fresh water.
Okay. That just occurred to me. I thought, man, if we get any saltwater backwash, you might say, that could be a little detrimental to some of the irrigation you wanted to be accomplishing right there.
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, there is a bit of a concern at the moment about invasive species utilizing the canal to get between the Hudson and the Great Lakes. Though that's another thing New York State is trying to mitigate.
Mm-hmm. Is that the Asian carp?
That's one of the things they're worried about. There's another fish called the round goby that they're worried about getting into Lake Champlain and the Hudson. Also zebra mussels. They've taken over the Finger Lakes at this point. They don't want them to reach the Hudson River. So we shall see.
I would say they would want to stay away. Your family lived on the border of the Minnesotas and Dakotas for a while. There's some zebra mussels there they would have had to be concerned about as well right now. So you don't want that either.
Sure. No. No one wants them.
So, agriculturally speaking, Derek, what have we not talked about the fascination surrounding Erie Canal in Western New York?
The Erie Canal also helped kind of spur a lot of major technological changes for agriculture. For instance, one of the first iron plows is developed in the Finger Lakes region shortly after the canal opens. Syracuse, New York produces the Syracuse chilled plow, which supposedly was excellent for turning up the soil of the Great Plains, especially. The first McCormick Reaper is like successfully commercially produced in Brockport, New York, in a factory right on the banks of the canal. So meanwhile, places like the Cornell School of Agriculture, one of the first kind of major agricultural research institutions in America, even produced the chicken nugget.
Cornell has always had a huge poultry research operation, which I guess that also is surprising. But I've had questions from listeners, poultry questions, and I have found a retired professor from Cornell in poultry who's been really helpful answering them. So your region has brought us a lot of great information. We appreciate that.
No problem. I'll take credit for it on behalf of New York.
You should.
Yes.
So as you think about other things that have been going on with the bicentennial, anything you want us to make sure that if we're sending people your direction to be touristy, that they should stop and see when you're there?
Well, obviously, I hope people check out the Erie Canal Museum in downtown Syracuse, New York. We're open 7 days a week from 10 to 4, and we're free to get in. So that would be great to check out. Another big thing happening for the bicentennial is the Buffalo Maritime Center has constructed a full-size replica canal boat of the first ever boat to travel from Buffalo to New York City, the Seneca Chief, which will be traveling from Buffalo to New York late September through October, stopping in a bunch of different canal towns. There's going to be big celebrations all along its banks. And there's a ton of other stuff to do this year. The Erie Canalway National Heritage Corridor at eriecanalway.org has an events page that lists all the stuff that's happening in the whole 350 miles of the canal as well.
All right. And Derek, we've got one of our callers, Greg, on line one, wants to talk about the canal. Greg, what you got for us?
Yeah, hey, you know, looking at some of these old encyclopedias that we got around the house, this is called the New Book of Knowledge. And they got about three pages of the Erie Canal quickly here. And basically it says construction of the Erie Canal began on July 4th, 1817 in Rome, New York. And when it was finished, this is cool. When the Erie Canal was finished, it was 363 miles, 584 kilometers long. So 363 miles long, the state of North Dakota, widthwise, 42 feet wide at the surface, and 4 feet deep. 4 feet deep because Lake Erie was 571 feet higher than the Hudson River. The canal contained more than 80 locks that were built to raise or lower vessels. And boats paved holes to use. Yeah, it was a boom. The traffic was so great. Why can't they get the guys here that are building a diversion? Why can't they use the same techniques? That took 8 years to 306, not 37 miles, which they're doing now, not 37 miles. Right. This is 363 miles with what you would call prehistoric equipment, right?
Well, not prehistoric, but I can tell you if they're going to be building a diversion around here, Greg, the Erie Canal was so much better. They had horses that they could use 24 hours a day, and they didn't have to worry about unions and environmental studies and so forth. Right, Derek?
I was about to say, a thousand Irishmen die doing that, too.
Yes.
To get somebody to organize it. No, this is really cool. Erie Canal, yeah. 4 feet deep. I wonder what the heck they that must have been floating bathtubs down the Erie Canal or something.
Hey, Greg, thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. Derek, before we leave, we're all dog lovers here. Anyone watching us on the live stream? What's your doggie's name and how old is he?
Oh, that was Harper. She's 3 years old.
Is she three? Yeah. She's very calm. I think she
that's why she was with me, because she was freaking out before.
And
be barking in the background here.
She was very, very good on camera. She's got a second career there or something.
There we go. Yeah. Sign her up.
Right. Well, Derek, thank you so much for joining us. We do appreciate it. And if anybody wants to get a hold of you or wants more information on the Erie Canal, what's a good place to go to?
They can check out eriecanalmuseum.org, or you can email me at educator@eriecanalmuseum.org. Also, our website's in a state of flux at the moment.
Okay.
Just so people are.
That's okay. Aware. That's okay. Well, Derek, thank you once again for joining us. And don't go anywhere. When we come back, we'll recap the weather. And I think Bridget has a couple more ag topics to go over. That and more when we come back. And welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus at 1:54 in the afternoon. And there's some light rain on radar down to the southwest of the FM area, stretching from roughly around Rutland up through the Dickey area. Moving east-southeastward. So this could clip areas around Lidgerwood over towards Hankinson as we head into the afternoon and early evening hours before scooting southeast. But that's all going to stay south of the 94 corridor. So if you have outdoor plans here in the FM area, we should be pretty good with temperatures currently in the low to mid-40s. That's nice to hear when our average high this year is about 20 degrees cooler than that. Should be in the mid-20s. So opposed to the frigid temperatures that we've been seeing for the last 2 weeks, two and a half really, we're finally seeing above normal temperatures, and it looks like this pattern is going to continue with a lot of 30s and 40s in the forecast over the next week to week and a half. So some pretty decent weather. Also, Bridget, we had one of our colleagues take a slip and fall, and she's got to have surgery right now. So, Sophia, if you're listening, get better quick, but it's tricky out there because people think that, hey, temperatures are above freezing. It's in the 40s. You still have icy spots on sidewalks and on a lot of parking lots if there's some melted snow that's on there, a very thin layer. And the reason being is the ground is still frozen. So if you have a thin layer of water, even with the temperatures above freezing, you could still get icy spots because the ground is still frozen, especially on untreated surfaces. So be careful, especially early in the morning. You're going to have icy conditions on some of those untreated sidewalks and parking lots, even with temperatures above freezing. So a lot of people think, it's above freezing. That's just wet. No, not all the time, not with the ground still frozen. So please be aware of that next couple of days.
Yeah, we're not out of the woods yet. Let's not be tripping and falling all over the place.
No, I know. Yeah, this is that time of the year that happens too often. So kind of be careful.
Very much.
There.
Well, here's a little something I don't think we were expecting to hear today. Honeybee rustling, like cattle rustling, but bees. Yeah.
Really?
Okay, so California is having some widespread honeybee losses over the winter months. Their almond, or as they would say there, their almond groves, are one of the first major crops in the U.S. that requires help with pollination. And this year, bee covers are really struggling to meet those calls with their bees because of a sudden die-off in the colonies. This is the symptoms that are reminiscent of the colony collapse disorder that was happening in 2007-08, where bees suddenly disappeared. What's been happening recently, though, is after inspections by field scientists, deceased colonies are often dead with ample honey storage there. They've been leaving small patches of their brood, and most all of the adult bees are missing. So this is some weird symptomology. It's been happening within 10 days of passing health inspections. So there are tests being done looking for pathogens. Could it be something else that's being entering into their environment that's causing a problem? But it's leading to a panic. And so hives are being stolen. The California Beekeepers Association is reminding people to label their hives. Maybe you should put an Apple AirTag on them too, because hives are being stolen and then resold or rented out to other farmers. The state has experienced an 87% increase in beehive thefts in the last 10 years. That's at over $300 million. It's tremendous how much this is havoc this is causing out there. So yes, it's not just the almonds, it's the blueberries, cherries, apples, and melons and pumpkins. We often think about apples here being self-pollinators, but some of those older heritage varieties are not, and that's where part of the problem's coming in. So bee rustling, alive and well. I just want to know who uses the tiny lariat for them to round them up, and is there a possibility there's a tiny bee sheriff with a badge? I know, tongue-in-cheek, I'm making fun of it. But good Lord, bees have now gone missing, and we're stealing the hives from the rest of them.
Well,
things I didn't think we'd talk about today.
Right? Wow.
Yes.
You learn something new on this show every day, it seems like.
Every day we learn something. It wasn't just about the Erie Canal today.
Right, exactly. Well, Bridget, I want to thank everybody for joining us here on Weather and Ag in Focus. if you're going to be outside, enjoy the milder weather. It's, again, a vast difference from last week. So for Bridget, myself, have a great afternoon. Don't go anywhere. The Jay Thomas Show is coming up next.